Today is Monday, November 6th. We're going to complete our information on spinal cord today, and if we have time, move into the brain information. Okay, so now that we have the spinal cord cross-section labeled, let's go through and talk about all the parts here. Let's use a reflex arc as a way to understand how the spinal cord and the spinal nerves work together. So in class on Wednesday of last week, we talked about placing your hand on a hot stove. That information is carried into the spinal cord by a particular root of the spinal nerve called?
Dorsal root.
Good. So the dorsal root brings information, which is sensory in nature, into the spinal cord. And most of the time, that information makes a stop at which of our gray matter horns?
Dorsal.
Good. And so if we're coming in, say, from this right side, we come in from the right dorsal horn, we make a stop at the right dorsal horn here on the back side of the spinal cord, and those interneurons are going to make a decision about what we should do. Those interneurons are going to be programmed that if there's pain or like a hot temperature associated with what you're sensing, the easiest thing to do to avoid further bodily damage is to just withdraw away from that point of pain. So those horns are going to tell your skeletal muscles to contract. So we skip over to which horn to initiate that motor control?
Ventral.
Yeah, skip over to the ventral horn. And so the ventral horn then initiates a motor response that comes right back out the ventral root. And this ventral root carries motor information through a mixed pathway that may go out to biceps and triceps brachii and, you know, make them move your arm away from that source of pain. So the catch here is that sometimes when you've got a reflex, you don't necessarily need the brain's involvement for the control of whatever the reflex is driving, like withdrawing your hand away from a hot source, like a pain from a stove. Now, we do know that once the information is reflexed through the spinal cord, we're also going to tattletale to the brain, and those dorsal horns contain interneurons that send information across the gray commissure. This information is heading over to one of these columns of white matter, and we're going to head up to the brain by way of an ascending tract. So when we send information from one side of the spinal cord up to the brain through another pathway, there's a name for this control. Do you recall that name? Left side of your brain controls right side of your body? Contralateral control. So that's what we're heading for here, is we're going to tell the left hemisphere of the brain that your right hand touched the stove, and the left hemisphere then sends a message back down the spinal cord. Okay, so do you feel a little more comfortable about the parts here? Okay, any questions on any of the parts so far? So in class on Wednesday of last week, and toward the last part of class, we were talking about, you know, ascending tracts that carried pain and temperature versus ones that carried, say, muscle and joint information. So let's head back there. All right, so we're about the bottom of page, mid to bottom page 105. So if we involve our brains in the circuit of tattletelling information, those ascending tracts are going to carry sensory information to our brains. If the information that we're taking to the brain happens to be pain or temperature related, we stop at a gateway or a relay station that's called thalamus. Good. And so in these pictures here, the thalamus is kind of like the first stop for information coming up the spinal cord. You probably don't think about the clothes that are in your body. I mean, you're conscious that you're not naked in here, right? Okay, we know we got clothes on, but you don't necessarily think about your clothes touching your body. That's not something you think about every second of every day. If it did, you couldn't think about much else. So your thalamus actually says, okay, that's too much information. Don't tell me anymore that your clothes are on. And so your thalamus says, I'm not going to bother your brain with this mundane, repetitive info. So it filters out stuff like that. Other important stuff like, oops, you just laid your hand on a hot stove, that is information that this gateway of the thalamus is going to let through. So when we're talking about information coming to the thalamus, It's the one that decides what the rest of the brain needs to be bothered with or what we just want to filter out and you know, not let go to the brain. Okay.
It's kind of like the front desk of the brain.
Very good. Front desk. Yeah. You've got to convince that front desk that you're important enough to get through to the rest. That's a great way to put it. Now, sometimes the information that goes up to your brain is going to be not pain or temperature related, but rather where your body parts are in space. I am pretty sure that you could close your eyes and get out of this classroom and at least down the hallway without bumping into too many things, right? Okay? You've been to this classroom enough this semester, you know how to get to and from here. That's because your body parts, you know, and your brain are aware of where you are in space. And so you can coordinate getting up without falling over. You can get your bag, you can get out the door, all with your eyes closed, simply through the coordination of your muscles, your receptors and your joints, and this cerebellum here at the back part of your brain. So when people are drunk, what do you think happens to this relationship between joints, muscles, and the cerebellum? It's not quite in control, right? Yep, so when we're drunk or when we're medicated or when we're sleeping, if somebody gets you up in the middle of the night, you can't make your way around your room. So that cerebellum has to be fully awake and able to process incoming information from muscles and joints so that it sends back the right message so you can move about. So we've actually got two stations here. We've got a gateway. I like your front desk analogy there. That's going to help keep out unnecessary info or allow pain and temperature to your brain. And the cerebellum helps us to coordinate our muscle movement and joint activities. So it feeds in information from where your joints are in space, and then of course it tells your body what to do. If you've ever seen somebody pulled for drunk driving suspicions, they have them get out, you know, put their arms out, touch their nose, right? And if you're drunk, then your body doesn't exactly know where your nose is. It's a little more difficult when you've got some alcohol in your system. So that's all part of that coordination activity tied into that cerebellum back there. But nonetheless, what we're talking about are ascending tracts that take information up to those two locations. So in this picture, those ascending tracts are colored blue, and you'll notice the red tracts here are descending in nature. All right, by contrast, what information is carried over a descending tract? Motor information, good. So motor information comes back down the spinal cord in these red colored tracts, and that information then gets carried out to the appropriate part of your body. So let's go back down to our picture here. When your brain makes a decision on how to handle information it's received, we come down through these descending tracts, we cross back over that gray commissure, that's contralateral control, and then we head back out the ventral route with the appropriate information. So again, we're just going to use that spinal cord kind of like an elevator, taking information up to your brain for processing and then bringing down directions to your spinal cord and to the appropriate spinal nerve. Okay. So that's kind of where we were in class on Wednesday of last week. We did talk about phantom limb pain and referred pain. Do you have any questions on those two? Okay, so phantom limb pain and referred pain, are they trouble with, say, an ascending tract or a descending tract?
An ascending tract.
So both of those are issues with information, sensory information, being carried up to the brain. All right, that should do it for page 105. How about questions so far there? You know, page 106 at the very top is hopefully just a great review for us. We talked about the epimyceum, perimyceum, and the endomyceum back in the last chapter. So this time what we're doing is just renaming it as neurium, and that indicates that we're talking wrappings around the nerve parts. So for instance, if we're talking about the wrapping around a fascicle or a bundle, what is that wrapping? Perineurium. And that is your bottom left arrow, your bottom left arrow. Okay, so a wrapping around a fascicle or a bundle of nerve cells is called perineurium, and that is your bottom left arrow. The wrapping around the entire muscle or nerve is starting with what prefix?
Epi.
Good. And that is which arrow?
Top
left one. Good. The individual wrappings around neurons and axons is the far right arrow, and that one is called?
Endoneurium.
Good. That's endoneurium on the far right arrow. Endoneurium. Let me emphasize the new terms on the bottom of your page. You'll notice that nerves can go by different names depending on where they're located. If the nerves are situated inside your central nervous system, then we call them tracts. Okay, so the term tracts indicates those nerves are riding inside your central nervous system. For instance, in this picture, we were just talking about descending and ascending tracts. Those are literally groupings of neurons that are housed in your spinal cord or even in your brain. So tracts are in your brain and spinal cord. When you hear us talk about the word nerve or ganglia, that indicates we're dealing with which nervous system branch? PNS, yeah, so peripheral nerves. And that includes things like spinal nerves and cranial nerves. So for instance, dorsal root ganglion, right off the bat, ganglion tells us PNS. Good. So there is some hidden meaning in the language there. So it looks like we're ready for page 107. How about questions so far today? All right, so in this picture, what they're showing us is called a ramus. A ramus is a branch of a spinal nerve. So I think most of this picture probably looks familiar. You've got your dorsal root ganglion. There's our dorsal root of the spinal nerve. Down below is our ventral root of the spinal nerve. And right here is where those two join and form a mixed nerve. And that travels through the opening between the vertebrae called the intervertebral foramen. And once that spinal nerve's emerging from the intervertebral foramen, you'll notice it immediately splits once again. Not into roots this time. These are neither sensory nor motor in nature. Instead, these rami are in fact mixed nerves at this point. So you've got a branch called the posterior ramus that travels to the back of your body, and you've got a ventral or anterior ramus or branch that travels to the front of your body. So if you can imagine the way that you put on a button-down shirt, that's how these rami work. If you're talking about the ventral rami, they start at your spine and they wrap you to the front. And just like a button-down shirt, they don't go any further than the midline of your body. So if you're talking about, say, a spinal nerve that wraps you from your back and innervates pectoralis major on the front, it only comes so far as your midline. It doesn't wrap you all the way around to the backside. It's not like going to gift wrap you all the way around. So all these spinal nerves that wrap us meet at the midline, basically from your pubic area all the way up to your brain, so the surface of your skull. So we've got cranial nerves and spinal nerves that wrap us in the same way, from the backside to the front, meeting at the midline. So let me emphasize that a ramus is a branch. Is a ramus a sensory, a motor, or a mixed nerve?
Mixed.
Good. It is mixed. Okay. And by saying that it's mixed, what does that mean? Yeah, got sensory and motor information. Good. Just to give you another idea of how this works, let's think of a muscle on our back. Can you tell me an example of one on your back? Latissimus dorsi. Good. Do you think a ventral ramus or a dorsal ramus, posterior ramus, serves your latissimus dorsi? Yeah, dorsal ram is good. Can you tell me an example of a muscle on the front side of your torso?
Pectoralis
major, good. Do you think a ventral or a dorsal ramus serves it?
Ventral.
Ventral, right. So front side is served by ventral rami or branches. Back side is served by those dorsal rami or branches. And that's just basically the way these things branch and operate. Interesting thing you can do with these branches, you can actually map them to the surface of the skin. And you can say, okay, this particular region of skin is served by, say, a thoracic spinal nerve or a sacral spinal nerve. This picture shows a color coding of dermatome mapping, and that gives us a really cool idea of which parts of your skin are served by which spinal nerves. So you can see the lighter yellowish-green color, those are cervical spinal nerves serving the neck and the arms. We've got the blue ones covered by our thoracic spinal nerves. The lumbars are serving that purplish area, and this red color back here is our sacral spinal nerves. So, you know, if somebody has a pinched sciatic nerve, it is in fact the sacral nerve, and they may experience numbness or tingling down the backside all the way from the buttocks down to the heel. So pretty interesting that you can relate a spinal nerve to the area of skin that it serves. Related to this is something I wanted to show you. Some viruses like to inflame our nerves. Chickenpox virus, which is varicella, loves to get into the nerves and cause inflammation. Later in life, sometimes people experience shingles, still that varicella virus causing inflammation. And we can actually trace which spinal nerves are being infected by that virus by looking at the skin surface and seeing what it follows. So shingles virus is in these pictures. You can see some chickenpox virus. These will always start at your spine and they'll work their way around to the front side. They will stop at your midline. They won't hop over the midline to the other side. In order for the other side of your body to be affected, we once again have to start at the back and then wrap our way around to the front following that ventral ramus. So, pretty interesting. You can see a patch of skin there being inflamed. Those blisters come from having inflamed nerves down below, so it translates up onto the skin surface. Pretty nasty virus, right? And this is an interesting picture. If you look at the girl on the left, you'll notice that only half her face is affected by an inflamed nerve. It perfectly stops at the midline and does not cross over. And that's because those cranial nerves also wrap you from the base of the brain around to your face, and they stop literally along the midline of your face and they go no further. So this nerve is inflamed up to this point, and to inflame this side of her face, that cranial nerve would have to be inflamed from the base of the brain all the way toward the front side.
So it would have to start at the back and move around just like a dermatologist.
Exactly. It has to start at the back and move its way that way. Yeah. And I think this picture of the tongue is probably the most striking example of how these spinal nerves work and cranial nerves. You can see half is inflamed with herpes virus and the other half is completely unaffected. You're either half lucky or half not lucky, right? All right. Any questions there on page 107? Feel pretty good so far? Okay. Let me take you over to page 108 and talk about the term plexus. Okay, so we talked about this picture starting off today. Now, when we come out here with this mixed spinal nerve, we know that it emerges through your intervertebral foramen and immediately it branches. And as it branches, the names for these branches are what?
Ramus.
Ramus. Yeah. So you've got a piece that's wrapping around your front side here. Because it's coming toward the ventral side of your body, we're going to call the ventral ramus. Thank you. piece that curls around and sticks at your backside. That's going to be your dorsal ramus. So imagine that your spinal cord is, you know, branching off 31 pairs of spinal nerves. That is an incredibly busy network on the backside of your body along your spine. What I'm going to do is I've extended down your spinal cord for just a little bit, and I'm going to make another dorsal root and a ventral root come off down here. Okay. And you can see they're going to come out through that intervertebral foramen. That's our spinal nerve. And then we're going to branch it off into another ramus at the back and another ramus at the front. And this is purposely going to look like a mess because that's how these plexuses form. When these things continually branch, there's no way for us to not have these nerves start to crisscross. And when these nerves start to crisscross with each other, that's what we call a network of a plexus. So this kind of the point of illustrating this just a little bit further. These crisscrossing networks form a plexus, and it allows for a kind of a backup plan in case you have one nerve that can't carry out a message. Okay, so what we're starting to build here is called a plexus. So to contrast the two terms, ramus means branch or arm, plexus means network. So far, so good. Any questions on ramus versus plexus? Okay, so let's go back and look at this picture. All right, so you'll notice that this gets to be quite a confusing looking mess when you've got ventral rami that are kind of crisscrossing past one another. That forms a network that allows for us to carry information either to a destination or from a destination. And if one nerve gets damaged in the network, then you may have another one that can still do the job. So it's beneficial as a backup route in case we have problems in that service area. This kind of sounds like cell phone towers and networks, doesn't it? So it's very much the same. There's overlapping nerves that serve the same area, just in case there is a problem. Now there's actually five important plexuses that we're going to cover. There's a cervical plexus in your neck region. What about the plexus that serves your arm?
Brachial,
good. There is a thoracic plexus that serves your ribs, but we're not going to really talk about that one. Instead, we'll talk about the solar plexus that sits behind your stomach and digestive organs. We'll talk about a plexus that runs down the front of your legs, known as?
Femoral.
Good. And the back of your legs?
Sacral.
Good. So we've got a lumbar plexus serving the legs and a sacral plexus as well. So we've got five primary plexuses that we're going to talk about. So let's do the cervical plexus first. Several of our cervical spinal nerves in the neck area are involved in our cervical plexus. There is one really important member to this grouping, and it's called the phrenic nerve. You'll want to highlight that one. Know it as the most important member of your cervical plexus. And what's it famous for? Good. So without it, you could not?
Breathe.
You couldn't breathe, exactly. So when people break a neck connection and they break that phrenic nerve in the neck, the half of the diaphragm supported by that phrenic nerve then can no longer contract. You know, oftentimes you hear about somebody diving into a really shallow swim pool or a pond and the unfortunate situation of breaking their neck in doing so. That can cause drowning simply because you can't breathe if you bring that person out of the water. You have to manually pump air into their lungs using CPR. So.
Isn't that right there? If that nerve was broken, it wouldn't matter even if you did break the air in because the diaphragm would be able to get air down into the lungs.
Yeah. Unless they put them on a ventilator and that's how they would breathe if they were kept alive. Yeah. No, they would not have one of those around a pond. You're right. So somebody had to keep pumping until they got them into a hospital situation. Yeah. All right. So you've actually got a phrenic nerve running down each side of your neck. It runs into your chest cavity, and each side stimulates your diaphragm. And interesting to note that when you have the hiccups, it is your phrenic nerve that is inflamed. And so the hiccup causes your diaphragm to jolt. And if you read the textbook about this cervical nerve plexus, they give you a really cool trick for stopping the hiccups. And they say that if you gently, don't push hard, right, gently put your hands around your neck and kind of push around your phrenic nerve, that'll stop your diaphragm from having the hiccups and contracting. Now, you don't want to push too hard because you've got common carotid arteries in the neck.
You cut off circulation.
You could pass out. So that's not the desired effect of pushing there, but it's just enough to calm the phrenic nerve and make you stop hiccuping. So, yep, it's caused by spasms of that phrenic nerve, nerve impulses. So I've got an 11-year-old daughter. I told her about it, and so she's really proud to say, Mom, you know, do the phrenic nerve thing, you know, and stop your hiccups. So give it a try. It works usually, you know, for us. Let's see. Brachial nerve plexus is next. It is in the arm region. And it's got five main nerves in it. And you'll want to highlight these as well. You've got a musculocutaneous nerve. And guess what that serves?
Muscles and skin.
Yep, muscles and skin. Good. You've got a median nerve. Guess where that's found in anatomical position? You got it. Right there in the middle. Okay. You've got an ulnar and a radial nerve. Guess which one runs pinky side?
Ulnar.
Good. And thumb side? Radial, good. And one last one? Good. Axillaries in your armpit. Yeah. So you can actually see in this picture they've color-coded the ulnar and radial nerves. If you have carpal tunnel syndrome, it's an entrapment of the nerve in that epineurium. And if that epineurium is too tight around the nerve, it causes carpal tunnel syndrome. If they split open that epineurium, that compartment, it lets that nerve relax and have a little more space and not be so inflamed in a tight encapsulation. So if you've got, say, numbness or tingling in one part of your hand and not the other, they'll say, we know what part it is. It's like ulnar nerve, it's if it's your pinky area, or it can even be your thumb and be your radial nerve. Likewise, if you hit your funny bone, that's your ulnar nerve. It ain't funny. No, you're right. And so that can travel all the way down and make your pinky kind of tingle, right? And if you're unfortunate enough to have an accident where you damage your armpit, you can damage your axillary nerve, and you can't raise your arm above horizontal, you know, all the way up. Yep. So interesting stuff we can learn from nerve injuries. What's that?
I said I didn't realize how dangerous it is to hurt.
Yeah, and cause permanent damage from muscle control, yeah. Lumbar nerves actually serve the front of your legs. And I'll tell you an easy way to remember this. Sacral, S, you sit on. Okay, you sit on your sacral nerves. So the lumbar serve the front side of your legs. The sacral nerves serve the back side of your legs. And the most important member of your lumbar plexus is your femoral nerve. So it runs down the front of your leg. It splits and becomes a tibial nerve that runs down the front of your shin bone, serves the front of your foot. But on the back side of your leg, you have a sacral nerve plexus. And we know those sacral nerves actually branch off that cauda equina. What is the cauda equina?
That's the tail.
Horse's tail, yeah. So at this point, when we're talking about sacral nerves, are you talking about a spinal cord or just spinal nerves? Just spinal nerves, yeah. So we know that L1, L2 is around the neighborhood for the spinal cord to end. And so all those nerves below that point are basically in that cauda, kind of that horse's tail that branches off. All right, so there is an important member of the lumbar, sacral plexus. That one is your?
Sciatic.
Good. And it's literally a pain in the butt, okay? If you are pregnant as a female, if you work in a job where you pick up heavy stuff, if you sit, if you don't sit the right way, then there's a little tiny muscle deep to your gluteus maximus, and it's called piriformis muscle right there. We don't study this one, thank goodness, right? It'd be one more to add to the list. So the sacral nerve, that sciatic nerve, actually goes through that area. If it becomes inflamed, it can push it down and pinch it. Yep. And so you now have pain that can travel all the way down the backside of your leg, even to your heel and your foot. So people don't oftentimes realize that if they've got pain in the lower leg, it's actually a pain in the butt. So if you can alleviate that through, say, physical therapy, then you can eventually get the rest of this inflammation to go away. Most likely, yes. Yeah, because that is the backside one, and it is the longest nerve in the body. Yeah. So if you happen to pinch this one, damage it, whatever, then you can affect sensation and motor skills all the way down the backside of your leg. All right. So make sure you highlight those important nerves, and we've got one last one. Behind your stomach, you have a nerve plexus here called solar plexus. And the important member here is actually two. You've got a splanchnic nerve that serves your bladder and your rectum. And you have a very important vagus nerve. Now, why are we talking about the vagus nerve? Our whole discussion today has been spinal nerves. What is the vagus nerve? Yeah, serves heart, lungs, digestive organs. And the odd thing is, it is a cranial nerve. Okay, so vagus nerve is a cranial nerve. It's cranial nerve number 10. And in Latin, vagus means to wander. Okay, so vagus nerve is a cranial nerve. It's kind of an oddball here. It's one of the few that leave your brain surface and travel away from your skull. This one wanders away down to your thoracic cavity and your abdominopelvic cavity. You're going to get to be good friends with vagus nerve in Bio-211. It is one that helps to control digestive functions. It promotes digestive activities. It is also one that helps to slow your heart rate down. So when people have a bowel movement and they hold their breath, and we all do it, you know, it's universal. When you have a bowel movement and you hold your breath, you're actually stimulating your vagus nerve to release acetylcholine onto your heart, and your heart rate slows. And if you've got an old person taking some heart medication, hold your breath, slow your heart rate. That's a great recipe for what? Passing out, yeah, and then maybe death. Yeah, so, you know, there's a really good conversation that we'll have about that vagus nerve getting into Bio-211. Really important cranial nerve that serves the solar plexus. So it's sitting behind your stomach and your digestive organs.
You stimulate the vagus nerve whenever you go to sleep?
Not necessarily. You'd stimulate it when you cough, when you hold your breath, when you dunk your face in cold water. Those are all things that will stimulate vagus nerve. Having a really full meal will also stimulate it. Pretty interesting one. We'll have some fun conversations about that one. Okay, so you got your nerve plexuses and their important members highlighted. Okay, you'll want to know what part of the body each one serves. So if we're talking about the backside of the legs, say hamstrings, tibialis anterior, that is? Sacral plexus, good. If we're talking about the nerve plexus that serves your arms?
Brachial.
Brachial, good. If we're talking about the nerve plexus that includes the vagus nerve?
Solar,
good. How about the nerve plexus that's important for breathing? Cervical. Good. Cervical in the neck. And the nerve that's important for stimulating your diaphragm? Phrenic. Good. Phrenic nerve. Good. And so of all these important members for our plexuses, the only one that's a cranial nerve is vagus. Okay. So not a hard one to remember, right? Vagus nerve. So we've come full circle. We started this chapter by talking about reflexes, so now we're going to actually do it formally. The bottom of your page covers reflex arcs, and I just want to mention that there's actually two types of these programmed automatic responses that occur in your body. So we consider reflexes to be either monosynaptic or we consider them to be polysynaptic. Okay? No matter how you look at it, they are very fast responses to a stimulus, and your spinal cord and your brain are actually programmed to do them. So it's almost like instinct, right? You don't have to think about it, you just do it. So let's take a look at a monosynaptic reflex first. Monosynaptic reflexes don't include an interneuron. It's a conversation that occurs directly between a sensory neuron and a motor neuron. So imagine that. There's no middleman. There's nothing slowing down this conversation. The conversation comes from a sensory neuron into the spinal cord. It synapses directly with the motor neuron that carries out the result. Okay, so it is a one synapse reflex, very, very fast. Mono is one, right? Poly is
many.
And who do we have involved in the conversation this time? Interneuron, right. So the sensory neuron comes in with the information. The interneuron says, hold on, let me talk to this one about it. Okay, we've decided this is how we're going to handle it. And now we're going to send the information back out a motor neuron. So there's a slight delay in getting the information back out the spinal cord. But still, this is a really fast way to manage input into the spinal cord. You'll notice with these spinal nerve reflexes, neither one of them requires the brain to make a decision. So if you put your hand on a hot stove, if you stub your toe, you do an automatic reflex to move away from the source of pain, and your brain never has to make a decision. Okay, you're going to feel the pain thanks to contralateral control. You're going to decide to put your hot burned hand under cold water thanks to contralateral control. But to pull your hand away from a hot stove, your brain has nothing to do with that reflex arc. Thankfully, right? Why is it good that your brain doesn't have to be involved? Yeah, you'd have a singed hand, right? Yep, so seconds to go up and back down for that decision to be made. Okay, so in this picture, look closely. We have information coming in from a muscle. It comes into the dorsal horn. Does it stop there to make a synapse with an interneuron? It skips it, right? It comes right back down to this ventral horn, and there's your first and only synapse. We come right back out to that muscle and make it contract or relax, whatever the reflex is going to be. So the catch here is a monosynaptic reflex is really fast. There's no interneuron. The spinal cord simply lets the message travel directly from a sensory neuron to a motor neuron. That's it, okay? So on your worksheet, you'll notice there's two examples here. A stretch reflex is one of them, and a knee-jerk reflex is the other. You ever lay in bed and stretch and point your feet, and you feel your gastrocnemius muscle clench up in a contraction? And then you got a Charlie horse that you can't get out of bed fast enough, right? And this is why I don't want to sleep in a loft, you know, because I think I'd break my leg getting down just to get the cramp to get out, right? Yeah, so if you've got that reflex where you've stretched and then you feel your Charlie horse come in the leg, that is a monosynaptic reflex. And what's happening is when your muscles feel this stretch, a sensory neuron tells your spinal cord, tattletale, they're stretching. And so the motor neuron says, I know what to do. You're overstretching. You might tear and rip that muscle. I'll tell the muscle to contract. And so in response, the muscle contracts, and then it contracts too hard, and you got yourself a Charlie horse, okay? That's a monosynaptic. Now you think about it when you stretch next time in the bed. You've got yourself a Charlie horse thanks to a synaptic reflex. Yeah, you can't move fast enough, can you? Knee-jerk is partly monosynaptic. You'll actually see one of these pathways here. The blue coming in is sensory. It synapses directly with an outgoing motor pathway. And notice we're down here in the ventral horn of the gray matter. That ventral horn controls what kind of activity? Motor, good. Is it voluntary or involuntary?
Voluntary,
yeah. Skeletal muscle, right. Now here's the catch. Is a knee-jerk reflex voluntary or involuntary?
Involuntary,
yeah. So it's automatic, but nonetheless, we're going to use the pathway that takes us to skeletal muscle contraction. So even though it's involuntary control this time, we're still traveling out that same pathway. We're traveling the neurons to take us to our appropriate destination. So yeah, part of this is monosynaptic since there's only one synapse between the sensory and motor neurons. Since we're looking at this picture, there's also a polysynaptic component. How would you say confirm that there is a portion here that's polysynaptic? Yeah, if you've got a green interneuron right there, okay, and that's going to communicate between an incoming sensory neuron in blue and the outgoing red motor neuron, okay? So part of this knee-jerk reflex is going to be a polysynaptic pathway. So you've probably heard people say, you know, I just did it. It was a knee-jerk response. I didn't think about it. And the meaning behind it is it's a really fast reflex, and yeah, your spinal cord doesn't think about it either. It just is an automatic reflex to having that patellar ligament struck with a little tool. So we've all had that done, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You feel out of control when you kick and you don't know why, right? This is another great example of polysynaptic. You know, we've talked about putting your hand on a hot stove and withdrawing your hand away from the source of pain. So polysynaptic reflexes are classically the withdrawal reflex that you experience when you stub your toe and pull your toe away, you pull your hand away from a hot stove. Even though it's extremely fast, you're still communicating through a layer of interneurons in the spinal cord. And they're kind of showing us here a pathway of contralateral control. That information does travel to the brain, and we've probably all done this. You burn yourself. You jerk your hand away, you say, oh, dang, that's going to hurt. The brain then finally gets the sensory information about a second or two later. So that's why we don't involve the brain in the reflex path. Yeah. Another example of a polysynaptic reflex is called the tendon reflex. You ever moved? You ever carried really heavy boxes? And you pick it up and you go, this is a dumb idea, but I'm going to do it anyway. And you think, I can make it from here to there with that heavy box. I can do it. It's just that far. So you pick up that heavy box, and you get about halfway there, and you're like, I'm going to drop it. Yeah. So if you can't get it down gently, your muscles and your tendons say, let it go. Okay? And so that's exactly what happens. There are muscle spindle fibers. There are receptors in your joints and your tendons. And if you rip a tendon, what are you talking about in terms of healing time?
Very long.
Yeah, months. So your tendons are going to send messages that say, hey, muscles, relax. And so your automatic response is to let go and drop the box. That keeps you from having really bad damage of tearing those tendons. All right. So that should take us down there to the bottom of the page. That is it for spinal cord information and spinal nerve information. How about questions so far?
Is there the blank on the page?
Is there... Let's see, on page 109 or 108, the part of the pathway that we have bypassed?
Brain.
And the next question, a polysynaptic pathway has an interneuron? And you don't have that in a monosynaptic pathway. So that next blank there is interneuron. right, so let's talk about the brain, and we will actually not cover cranial nerves in lecture. Cranial nerves will be done in lab, so we'll only cover the brain here in lecture. All right, so top of page 110 is where we're at. Let's talk about the protection for the brain. The brain is also covered by the skull. We do have three meninges, or membrane layers, here. And just like on the spinal cord, from superficial to deep, they are DAP, dura, arachnoid, and pia mater. Okay, and so the dura mater is what we consider to be the tough outer covering of the brain. It actually adheres to your skull on the inside. The arachnoid layer is more like a spider web-like layer, and it's renowned for having the cerebrospinal fluid circulate through it. And where does pia mater anchor? Around the brain. It's closest to the brain. I've often heard it described as a shrink wrapping. It's very tightly anchored to your brain itself. And if you were to try and take away the pia mater, you'd be plucking away brain tissue itself. So pia mater is really anchored tightly, like shrink wrap, to your brain tissue. I wanted to show you this picture so we could talk about the fissures around the brain and a piece of dura mater that wedges itself into that fissure. A fissure is a really deep crack or groove. This is going to be a really nasty conversation, by the way. Really deep crack around your brain, and like cracks, they get wedgies, right? Okay, so there's a wedgie of dura mater that gets stuck into your fissures. And you can see right here, this V-shaped piece is dura mater, okay, right there. And that dura mater is going to be wedged into that fissure. Now, the reason I make a point about this is, in just a moment, we're going to talk about sinuses. Not these sinuses that get clogged up with mucus, but sinuses that are actually large veins that travel around your brain. There are sets of sinuses that are sitting in the dura, and they're called dural sinuses because they sit in these little wedgie-like folds. So when we talk about collecting fluids from your brain, we pull those fluids back into dural sinuses because they sit into those V-like wedges. Okay, so I'll show you some. I've got a couple of pictures of them. This crack back here between your cerebrum and cerebellum is called the transverse fissure. There's a wedged piece of dura mater that goes into that fissure, and the blood vessel in there is called the transverse sinus. Like I said, not mucus-producing sinuses, but just rather really big veins. Here's another one found between your two cerebral hemispheres. This is another dura mater fold. It goes into the longitudinal fissure, and this blood vessel is called a superior sagittal sinus. Okay? So these sinuses are actually really big veins. They pick up fluids from your brain, and they drain the fluids and the blood back to your jugulars in your neck, and then back into full-on circulation. Okay, so we'll tie these into CSF flow in just a little bit. Okay, so I need to give you the backstory about cerebrospinal fluid for just a moment. Okay, so your brain is an unusual organ. It needs a lot of oxygen. It needs a lot of glucose. In fact, they estimate that 25% of your glucose is used up by your brain. That's a lot of sugar that your brain consumes just to run its energy to make ATP. Now, the catch is your brain is kind of sensitive to having everything circulate through it. So we actually don't allow the blood to make contact with your brain tissue. We allow certain things in your blood to escape to the surrounding brain tissue, but we don't want everything reaching that brain tissue. What are some important things you might want to let your blood give to your brain?
Oxygen.
Oxygen. Anything else?
Fluids,
maybe? Glucose. Okay. And so we might want to give these things to our brain, but we're not going to do so by way of the bloodstream. Some of the things that your blood can also carry are bad. Not just waste, but what else? Bacteria, viruses, okay?
Toxins.
So we basically say to your brain, hey, we'll give you the good stuff that you need, but we'll keep the bad stuff away from you. So we don't actually do the exchanges through capillaries in your brain like you might expect. We do the exchanges through a fluid that's called cerebrospinal fluid. And what you're looking at here is a capillary that flows through the brain, and it is surrounded by these ciliated ependymal cells. Now, thinking way back, these are a type of neuroglial cell, and they help to pull fluids out of your bloodstream and create the cerebrospinal fluid. So some of the things that are important to give to your brain are exactly what you told me. Things like glucose, oxygen, vitamins, ions. But notice, none of the bad. We don't want to pull out and give the brain viruses, toxins, waste products, and bacteria. So we don't allow those things to cross the capillaries and form the cerebrospinal fluid. We may have bacteria traveling through the brain, but it stays in the bloodstream and unable to contact the brain tissue. So how crazy is that, that you've got blood traveling through your brain, but it's the cerebrospinal fluid that's actually nourishing your brain tissue and your spinal cord tissue? Very sensitive to stuff, yeah. So what we were looking at in this previous picture, this little knot of capillaries is called a choroid plexus, not to be confused with the plexus we just talked about, right? This little knot of capillaries is like taking a dirty rag and squeezing out the good stuff. So it's a kind of a pressure point here that pushes out the good stuff for CSF circulation.
It secretes it.
It secretes it, yeah. So it moves it out of the bloodstream and into a different flow path. And in this picture, you can actually see that flow path. These horn-shaped structures in the brain are called ventricles. And the CSF flows from those choroid plexuses that are situated near these ventricles. Now the fluid flows into these horn-shaped structures. And that allows for oxygen and glucose to travel to your brain tissue. Okay? So from this point, we're going to travel from these lateral horns that curl into the two ventricle or two sides of the brain, and then that fluid flows straight down. And all we have to do is keep those structures in order. So if you flip the page with me to 111, let's take a trip with our cerebrospinal fluid. So we've got choroid plexuses in a few locations. We're just going to pick one as our starting point. We're going to pick the choroid plexuses that are sitting in your lateral ventricles, and we're going to move down from there. So we've got choroid plexuses taking the good stuff out of blood, making cerebrospinal fluid. That fluid travels through these lateral ventricles that coil into each of our hemispheres. From there, we travel through a tiny little opening. It's a hole called the interventricular foramen. The old name for it is foramen of Monroe, but they're trying to get away from old names and go with more modernized names, not named after people anymore. So we'll call it interventricular foramen. We next travel into a third ventricle that's situated between your two brain hemispheres. And now we travel through a very tight, narrow passageway called cerebral aqueduct. You notice that we're just going down. Now we're down into a diamond-shaped fourth ventricle, okay? And it's actually down here kind of around your thalamus, your cerebellum, your pons. And then now we're entering into the spinal cord inside that area called the central canal, okay? Let's do it from the top. We make CSF in the choroid plexuses. We're going to pick the ones inside the lateral ventricles. That CSF flows into the lateral ventricles and then into the interventricular foramen. The next ventricle we encounter is which one?
Third
ventricle. Good. From the third, we travel into a very tight, narrow passageway called the cerebral aqueduct. Good. Next stop is the fourth ventricle. And then where? Good. Central canal of the spinal cord. Let's flip pictures. We travel all the way down. And like a drippy faucet, your CSF drips off the terminal portion here, exits the spinal cord around L1 or L2, And now it circulates in the subarachnoid space. That arachnoid space sits between your dura mater and your pia mater. Okay? So we're now heading back up to your brain. The CSF circulates around the outside of your brain. And then it gets reabsorbed back into the bloodstream by way of one of these dural sinuses. That little out pocket right there that looks like a spiderweb explosion, that's called an arachnoid villus. And so that arachnoid villus allows for cerebrospinal fluid to get pulled back into the bloodstream. And so the blood now picks up whatever the spinal cord may have donated. And let's go back to our picture here. These are the dural sinuses, the ones traveling around the fissures of your brain. Okay? And so that is the pathway that we're going to take. Basically, there's no first or second ventricle here. We go from lateral ventricles to third to fourth, then the central canal and the subarachnoid space and back for reabsorption. This, by the way, is a guaranteed essay question on test number 4. And I'm pretty certain this is also a guaranteed essay question for lab. Okay, so you can kill 2 birds with 1 stone with this tracing. All right, one more time from the top. So where is CSF made? Choroid plexuses, good. And we're going to pick the ones located in your lateral ventricles. So we'll go from the choroid plexus to the lateral ventricles. We travel through a tiny hole called? Good. We now travel through a ventricle called? Good. Through a tiny passageway called? Good. Now into a larger?
Fourth ventricle.
Good. And then down to the?
Central canal.
All right. And then from the central canal, we drip at the tip of the spinal cord. And then?
Subarachnoid
space. Arachnoid villi.
To dural sinuses.
Good. So you hop out of the blood, you take a detour, you hop back in the blood, and you're done. That's basically what CSF flow is. Okay? So it's a way to give good stuff to the brain and not have to bother the brain with bad stuff, like viruses, toxins, bacteria, things of that sort. Like we talked in class on Wednesday last week, they can do lumbar taps into that spinal cord. They can take fluid in that CSF pathway from your subarachnoid space and sample it. Likewise, an epidural works the same way. Instead of extracting fluid, we can inject medication in, and then it joins that CSF flow. I did want to mention this issue called hydrocephaly. If a baby has too much CSF, there's too much pressure there. The benefit for this child is he's probably under age 1, and you'll notice that his head is swollen because of all this excess fluid. The benefit is because his skull has not fused, the skull is flexible and allows for the fluid to not damage his brain. It's like a water balloon, right? For anyone older than around ages 1 or 2, our brains have hardened. Those soft spots are no longer soft. And what happens to your brain?
It's going to start getting pressure buildup.
Pressure buildup, right. So that excess fluid can actually cause brain damage if you're older than about 1 or 2 years old, because this pushes on your brain, and it's just like a soft, ripe fruit, like a peach. If you push on it, you're going to bruise and damage the outer portions of the brain. So, you know, they can put in a shunt that pumps off this excess fluid and prevents the brain from being damaged. They can actually put the fluid into a shunt in the chest. This picture here shows normal CSF. You'll notice right here are the lateral ventricles. There's our baseball diamond-shaped fourth ventricle, okay? And you've got a fairly good amount of space around the outside of the brain. You're not pushed right up against the skull. But in a case where somebody might have had, say, a stroke or something where they've interrupted that blood flow and CSF flow, big, huge pool of fluid here, the brain is pushed against the skull. And if brain damage occurs in that outer 1/8 inch of your brain, then conscious thought and functioning is done. So that can actually render a person into a vegetative state if that CSF fluid accumulates around the outside of the brain.
So it makes you put them into a coma?
Kind of like a coma, yeah. Or they may be awake and conscious and just completely unresponsive. So, pretty bad situation if it gets to the point of that.
Is that why, like, if somebody gets brain damage or something, like, if they hit their head, there is a lot of people sleeping those because their brain's slowly going into, like, a coma?
Possibly, and if the thalamus is no longer keeping us awake, then, yeah, you will lose consciousness and go to sleep. Yep. And it may be a coma-like sleep. Why don't we pick up with blood-brain barrier in here on Wednesday, and we're going to label page 115. There's a brain picture there. We'll label that one together, so if you would like an extra copy to go ahead and play with, you may want to print off 115 so you got a couple of extra copies.